The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello, and welcome to Short Circuit, your biweekly excursion into the Federal Courts of Appeals. I'm your host, Robert Everett Johnson, filling in for John Ross. I'm joined by Evan Burnick of the Institute for Justice's Center for Judicial Engagement, as well as crack constitutional litigator Erica Smith. This week on the podcast, a town cracks down on sex toys, calling an endodontist, calling political candidates by name, and the IRS holds up a tea party. Evan, want to start us off?
Yeah, this case comes out of the 11th Circuit and involves a criminal ban on the commercial sale or distribution of sex devices or sex toys in the city of Sandy Springs, Georgia. The ban was passed in 2009. The Supreme Court has subsequently decided a couple of cases that have recognized a constitutional right to consensual sexual intimacy in the privacy of one's home. And a couple of plaintiffs have now challenged this ban, even though it was upheld prior to the Supreme Court cases, with the intent of basically saying the Supreme Court has, in effect, held that you got it wrong and you need to revisit this case. And the question is whether that precedent can still stand up, given what the Supreme Court has subsequently decided.
I'd like to point out that the lead plaintiff in this case was particularly sympathetic because she's a woman with multiple sclerosis, and she's not able to have normal sexual relationships with her husband because of that. And that was why she was alleging the right to buy these sex toys.
Right. So this is not just a case about buying sex toys. This is a woman who literally cannot engage in private consensual sexual intimacy, which the court has said is constitutionally protected, unless she can acquire and she can use these sex toys. One of the other plaintiffs wanted to use the sex toys in his art. So there's a First Amendment dimension. But really, the fundamental question in this case, there are two fundamental questions that make this case interesting. One is, at what level of generality do you define a claimed right? Is this just about the right of an individual to purchase a particular device at a particular time in a particular context? Or is it about a broader right to enjoy consensual sexual intimacy and to not have the government simply on the basis of moral disapproval prevent you from doing something? So that's question one. Question two, when the Supreme Court articulates a principle, how are lower courts to interpret that principle? Are they supposed to say, well, if the Supreme Court hasn't said that this precise exercise of a constitutional right is constitutional protected, well, then therefore it doesn't apply? Or do they say, well, what is the court really saying here? What are the fundamental principles that it's relying upon? And do we revisit precedent that is in tension with those principles? And here the court basically defines the right at a very low level of generality, says this is only about sex toys. Supreme Court still hasn't spoken about sex toys. Therefore, until an en banc court rehears this and decides otherwise, we'll continue to acquiesce in that precedent.
And so the plaintiffs here were saying that they had a right under Windsor and Obergefell, the two Supreme Court cases on the issue of gay marriage. And how did the court distinguish those earlier decisions?
It didn't really distinguish those earlier decisions in a convincing way. It basically said they didn't involve sex toys. I mean, the relevance of those cases is twofold. So Windsor stands for the proposition that, yes, consensual sexual intimacy is protected, and the government can't demean that or interfere with that, even if that simply means, in the context of Windsor, defining marriage for the purpose of receiving federal benefits in a particular way. If that demeans your relationship, the government can't do that. And Obergefell stands for the proposition that in the context of marriage and sexual intimacy, you don't define rights at the most narrow possible level of generality. You look to the broader principle. And here the principle is these individuals want to have consensual sex with the persons of their choice in private. They are unable to do so without these devices. Therefore, this interferes with their ability to engage in sexual intimacy.
The court's opinion was really alarming here because under the court's reasoning, unless the Supreme Court comes in and says exactly what the government can't interfere with, what's going on in your private bedroom, then the government can go in and regulate that. So unless the Supreme Court says that you have a right to engage in exact, whether it be the exact sexual position or the exact sexual preference, you have no right to that conduct.
Right. And the other point worth making here is just about this court's attitude towards precedents. Precedents are supposed to be authoritative evidence of what the law is. But there's always room for independent judges to consider whether a precedent is actually consistent with the Constitution, unless they're faced with an order from a higher court that says specifically act in this particular way. For this court to simply just reflexively accept a precedent that's been undermined by a couple of Supreme Court decisions and say, even if we're convinced that it's wrong, we'll wait for an en banc court to solve it, really is an abdication of judicial responsibility.
So is that the end of the road for this case?
Unless and until the en banc court, an en banc court, which is a full court of the 11th Circuit, says we got it wrong several years ago in light of Supreme Court precedent, this is the end of the road for this particular case.
All right, Erica, want to tell us about endodontics?
Sure. So this case is Kaiser versus Comdair out of the 6th Circuit. And what's happening here is you just have a dentist in Ohio who wants to put on a sign outside of his business that he is both an endodontist and he also practices general dentistry. And for listeners who don't know, an endodontist is someone who specializes in dental tissue and does a lot of things like root canals. So in Ohio, it's perfectly legal to both practice a dental specialty and do general dentistry, but you can't tell the public that. So the Ohio Board of Dentistry told him his sign can't say this. He can either pick one or the other. He can either say, I'm a specialist, or he could either say, I do general dentistry. And the court rejected this restriction under the central Hudson test, which is the test under the First Amendment that governs government restrictions on speech. And with really great language about the court's need to scrutinize evidence and not just accept the government's rationale, the court said there is no justification for this. The Ohio Board of Dentistry said that they have an interest in distinguishing between specialists and generalists, but there's no reason to think that restricting the sign in this matter would do that. The sign is perfectly truthful. People understand what he's talking about when they see it, and this restriction is not narrowly tailored to serve an important government interest. So I thought this opinion did a great job of really taking the government to the task and looking at the evidence instead of just simply rubber stamping the restriction.
So one of the issues that we deal with at the Institute for Justice a lot is the distinction between speech and conduct in the First Amendment area. Does the court say anything about that?
They do. They really emphasize that if conduct is legal, the government can't stop you from advertising that conduct. And that's something that we litigate a lot at IJ. And in fact, the court primarily relies upon one of our opinions in Pagan for that proposition.
Yeah, and this is a mistake that the district court below actually made. They said that, well, this is just about the advertisement of illegal conduct. But the fact is, it's not illegal to practice general dentistry, and it's not illegal to practice endodontics. The only thing that the dental board was making illegal in this particular instance was for him to advertise his services in a particular way, to speak in a particular way. And to the extent that the government is saying you cannot speak in a particular way, this isn't about conduct, this is about expression, and that triggers the protections of the First Amendment. That means Central Hudson. That means you cannot get away with simply making unsupported assertions about government interest. You need to have evidence. That evidence needs to be credible, and you need to show that the means you have chosen to effectuate your credible interests are tailored to the problem that you're trying to address. That's what the court insists upon in this case, and when it goes back down to the district court, we now have a blueprint for what the analysis should look like.
So, Erica, what was the actual holding of the case?
Well, the Sixth Circuit found that the district court was wrong to dismiss the case, and it remanded with very stern instructions on what the district court should do.
And what was the district court supposed to do?
Let the case go forward and most likely strike this restriction down.
Evan, do you want to take us over to the D.C. Circuit?
Yeah, so this case involves a Federal Election Commission rule that prohibits unauthorized political committees. That means political committees that are not associated with a particular campaign, from using candidates' names in the titles of their websites and social media pages, so long as they are supporting a particular candidate as opposed to opposing them. A political committee that works for the election of federal office holders, Pursuing America's Greatness, that's the name of the political committee, wanted to use the candidates' names in the titles of its media and websites and social media pages, and it challenged this FEC restriction on the First Amendment as what we call a content-based restriction on speech. If you support a candidate, you cannot use the names of those candidates in social media or your websites. But if you oppose a candidate, you can. That is a content-based restriction on speech, and the Supreme Court has recently spoken to this very issue.
That's right. And practically under this regulation, I could have a Facebook page that says, vote against Mike Huckabee, but I can't have a Facebook page that says, I like Mike Huckabee, as if I'm a political committee. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. You need to inspect the contents of the speech in order to determine whether it is or is not subject to this regulation. And the Supreme Court recently held in a very important case, Reed v. Town of Gilbert, or rather reaffirmed, it has long said this, that if government officials need to inspect the content of your speech to determine whether it's going to be applicable, it's going to be under a given regulation, that means strict scrutiny, the most demanding form of scrutiny that our constitutional law has.
And there was no way that the government was going to survive strict scrutiny in this case. They were arguing that they needed this restriction because otherwise people would be confused when they looked at these Facebook pages and these websites, because they would think that those pages were officially sponsored by a political candidate. But the government already requires disclosures on these pages saying that they aren't associated with the candidate. So this argument fell flat and the court just didn't buy it.
Right, because under strict scrutiny, you need to show that not only do you have a compelling interest, but what you've done is narrowly tailored to that interest. If you have an alternative means that's less restrictive of speech, you are obliged to have recourse to that alternative. And the government in this case didn't do that.
So certainly a speech protective decision. At the end of the day, though, where does the law stand? How regulated are these political action committees?
They're very heavily regulated in substantial part because the Supreme Court has acquiesced in a distinction between direct prohibitions on political speech and so-called disclosure requirements, requirements that individuals and organizations turn over information which theoretically informs voters about where money is coming from and how it's being spent. The fact of the matter is that freedom of speech encompasses not only the freedom to speak, but the freedom not to speak if you do not want to speak about a particular subject. And the Supreme Court's distinction and its submission of a more minimal level of scrutiny to disclosure requirements as opposed to direct prohibitions on speech means that political committees are very heavily regulated, and it's very difficult to navigate the regulations that these committees are under.
So a helpful decision, but ultimately perhaps a drop in the bucket. Erica, do you want to tell us about the IRS and Tea Parties?
It's a shame that we're still talking about this and still litigating this case. What happened is that for the last few years, the IRS has had a targeted campaign against conservative and Tea Party groups that when they apply for 501c status or 501c4 status, the IRS was dragging out their applications and asking them plenty of inappropriate questions. And none of this is in dispute. Even the U.S. Inspector General has laid this all out in a detailed report, but it's still going on, and it's still being litigated.
It's still being litigated because even though the IRS is not defending and cannot defend its discriminatory treatment of these organizations on the merits, it's now arguing that the controversy is moot, meaning that the constitutional claims that these organizations are now bringing based on that discriminatory conduct shouldn't be heard in court, shouldn't go forward, because essentially we promise never to do it again. The problem with that argument is that not only does such voluntary secession need to be unambiguous, such that there is no reasonable doubt that this is never going to happen again, but actually the IRS still hasn't processed the applications of these litigants that are now bringing constitutional claims based on the differential treatment of their submissions.
And perhaps even more disturbing, the IRS itself said they're only stopping until further notice. I was really shocked that the district court bought that this was enough to moot the case.
Right. And the D.C. Circuit is very aware of what's going on here. It makes absolutely plain that we promise never to do this again is not sufficient. And there's even an amusing reference to Catch-22 and that the court gets into here. The whole idea that you can't bring a constitutional claim if you're enmeshed in litigation about how we've treated you in the past. It puts you in a situation where essentially you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. These appellants still can't get the relief that they're seeking, and they can't get the relief that they're seeking because the IRS is still dragging out this litigation process. The D.C. Circuit makes very clear that this is not appropriate grounds to moot a case and that therefore these claims should go forward.
All right. Well, that's a wrap. If you have any thoughts and comments, send them to shortcircuit@ij.org. Erica doesn't tweet, but you can follow her on Twitter anyway at ErikaSmith1717. You can follow Evan at Evan Burnick and yours truly at Free Range Lawyer. Until John Ross's return, this is Robert Everett Johnson of the Institute for Justice, politely suggesting that you get engaged.